Welcome to the Embodiment Conference 2020, also on behalf of the whole team behind the scenes. Thank you for your attention to another amazing presentation about intimacy and relationship. My name is Ilan Stefani and it's my pleasure to be sponsoring this channel, as I deeply believe that aliveness, embodiment, intimacy, relationship are key to individual and global change. My ongoing somatic research is focused on more and more aliveness for each and every one of us. I tune into the fields of collective trauma, of intimacy, of love and rage, shadow work, and higher level of energy. If you are curious about my work, you might want to catch my presentation on this channel as well as on the main stage. And you can also head over to my website, ilanstefani.com. My methods have been described as an embodiment training for warriors. However, you are so welcome to find out yourself. I teach online and in person. I teach in German as well as in English. Thank you for your attention and please enjoy the following presentation.
I'm so happy and excited to be introducing Nicole Gibson today, who's going to speak to us about how embodying love unlocks our limitlessness. Nicole is a multi-award-winning social entrepreneur. She is the CEO of a global movement, Love Out Loud. We'll be posting the link for that in the chat so you can see what she does. And she has had impressive achievements. What can I say? Since a very young age, 18, 20 years old, she's been going out there speaking about love in the world. And I'll stop talking because we all want to listen to what she has to say. Over to you, Nicole.
Thank you, Virginia, and thank you everyone for joining. Please, I just want to reiterate, feel free to turn your cameras on, interact with me. I love when these experiences can be two-way, and you know, there's so many things that we can talk about and break down when it comes to the conversation of embodying love. So if there's a way that I can tailor, I guess, my experiences and my discoveries in working with all of the incredible human beings that I've had the privilege of working with over the past 10 years that will support you, then I really want to be able to offer some specific and directive support. So just jump in the chat, talk to me, introduce yourself. I thought I would just begin by setting a little bit of context around the work that Love Out Loud's doing in the world. And most importantly, I think what actually led us and me as a leader to this kind of this end point and this beginning point of all things that I will go on to pursue in life, being love. What's really unique about the unfolding of my journey was just the amount of humanity I've had the opportunity to be exposed to from a very young age. And one thing that when people say, you know, you're an expert in these fields, one of the counter arguments that I'll say back to that is I truly believe that any human being, if they had seen and been exposed to the breadth of humanity across such a scope of diversity that I have been, they would probably have quite similar conclusions, if you want to call them conclusions. So I want to take you a little bit into that story, where that began. I had a very unconventional childhood. I went to about 10 different schools. I was a very naughty kid. I was always breaking rules, going against the grain. I didn't understand systems. When teachers would say, you have to think outside the box, I got genuinely confused that there was even a box that people thought within. So like breaking out of systems was kind of like a natural default, very rebellious spirit from pretty much inception. And that got me into all sorts of trouble. I grew up between London and Australia and traveled immensely. So I had quite a breadth of cultural exposure from a very young age. I struggled to fit into traditional education system. So I decided to leave when I was 14 to pursue performance, which was one of my loves. And I was put into this environment where I had such an opportunity to create like a kinship with the people around me. We had commonalities, we were all artistic, we really should have been there to support one another. But one of the things that no one taught me at a young age, which I think so many of us can relate to, was when you don't have the foundations of self-love, it doesn't matter the amazing gifts, opportunities that get presented to you in life, you don't have strong foundations in which to jump into those opportunities from. And so I had incredible opportunities to pursue what I was most in love with, but I didn't love myself. So the more amazing the opportunities got, the deeper the feelings of unworthiness and polarization became. And so that created a descent of my mental health. On one hand, I had this incredible trajectory. On this other hand, I had a really conflicted internal world. And I started to recognize that really everything we experience and why I'm so connected to the intention of this conference has to first come within, from within. And there was a decline in my mental health that eventually became a really severe battle with an eating disorder. And I was at this point in my journey where I thought I was ticking all of the boxes that a young aspiring performer needed to tick in order to succeed. And most importantly, I thought that I was really becoming the ideal of what it meant to be a woman in the world as well, because that's what had been role modeled to me. And I found myself in this position where I felt like I had done everything right, but I was feeling crippled, alone, isolated. And more than that, I got to meet an edge of where we're at culturally that became the pivotal point of awareness in my life's work, which is most of us have grown up in a culture when we're exposed to deep vulnerability, someone's deep vulnerability or deep pain or deep fragility, we don't know how to be in that. Which is why the conversation of embodiment is so important. Because a lot of people will ask me in my work today, you know, what is the right thing to say to someone that's struggling? What is the right thing to do? And there's no answer to that. The answer's in the beingness. How willing are we to be present with what's truly present? And to me, this is what fundamentally will change the world, when we can actually fully be present with the realities of what us as individuals go through with ourselves, first and foremost, and then with the realities of what's playing out globally, because the micro is not separate from the macro. And so I had a very lived experience of this growing up, being someone that went from having it all to then being the object of almost like the elephant in the room, because I was wearing the eating disorder so physically that was the first thing people were meeting every time they came into contact with me. And so I experienced, as a 16-year-old, thinking that that was rejection, thinking that I wasn't lovable, thinking that I wasn't deserving of the support and care that I needed. In reality, people were so afraid that they were going to say the wrong thing. People were so afraid that they were going to do the wrong thing, give the wrong advice, and they felt unequipped. And what we fail to recognize when we approach difficult situations in that frame, what if I say the wrong thing? What if I do the wrong thing? What we're failing to understand is we're actually in a cycle of self-orientation. We're not being present with what's in front of us. And that's no one's fault, because not many of us have actually taught to be comfortable with hard emotions. And we have emotions that have been glorified and made to be like, these are our favorite emotions and these are our emotions that, you know, we want to abandon and not look at. But that has really detrimental effects. An analogy I often give is, imagine if you had, you know, 20 children and that was your emotional spectrum, and you divided them in half and you put half of them outside in the rain and said, I'm just going to ignore you. I'm not going to feed you. I'm not going to give you water. You can fight for the doghouse. And I'm basically just going to abandon you and good luck. And with the other emotions or the other children, you're like, I'm going to give you the best education. I'm going to treat you like royalty. I'm going to give you everything that you need. This is really the relationship so many of us have with our emotions. And it's a simple conversation, but it's a very profound conversation when you start to understand that until we reconcile ourselves, we're not actually equipped to make these profound changes that I know probably all of us in this container are passionate about in the world. It has to really begin there. And the reason I go back to this point in my journey was because I was exposed to a style of leadership that, one, I didn't know existed, and two, completely transformed my life, which was a conversation that my school principal, or the equivalent of my school principal, because I wasn't a traditional school, had with me at that time when everyone else was in a constant state of hesitation. He chose to approach things very differently. He tapped me on the shoulder one day at school and he said, "Can I have a conversation with you in my office?" And I remember feeling terror and shame. They were probably the first two emotions that I felt, because I remember thinking, he wants to talk to me about my health and I feel like I've done something wrong. So there I was, suffering, not able to really have a voice and feeling like I was burdening others around me. And this is often what happens to people who are in severe states of vulnerability. When we don't know how to lean into that, be with others in their experience, not only are they feeling their own suffering, they actually then take on the responsibility of our discomfort. And so that polarization will just continue. And this is a pattern that really needs to be broken in the world if we want to start to unify and come together. And this is why, again, embodiment work is so important. So he was probably the least likely candidate to be having this conversation with me, considering he was a 50-year-old alpha male Aussie, right? Aussie male culture, it's very rough. He went in and said, "Please have this conversation with me." And I remember feeling terrified and ashamed, and I followed him to his office and he sat down. And at this point, the fear of the confrontation of the conversation actually left me physically paralyzed to the point that I couldn't sit in a proximity to him. I had to go and sit on the other side of his office, which was like a big office. So there I was sitting meters away from him, and I actually braced myself. I was waiting to be yelled at. And what he said completely just broke that expectation. He said, "I'm not here to make you feel afraid. I'm here to let you know that you're not alone in going through what you're going through." And how profoundly simple that position was, and how powerfully shifting that statement was. "I don't want you to feel afraid. I just want you to know that you're not alone in this." And then in that moment, that was the first time in years of quite deep suffering every day, self-punishment, self-hatred, that behavioral pattern that I was in through the eating disorder. I'd never cried. I'd never felt safe enough to actually let go and feel what was really underneath. And I just completely broke down. And that was because I, for the first time, had space to feel. Someone was giving me enough safety to actually feel, and I had enough space to be present with what was present. And he didn't try and stop me from crying. He didn't come and tap me on the back or, you know, like be like, there, please stop crying. He just let me cry. He didn't try and fix me. He didn't try and save me. He just let me be in it. And after about 20 minutes, he said, "Do you know what my favorite thing to do after school is?" And I was in a state, like I had snot all over me, like tissues everywhere. I was like in no state to be answering any questions. So I shook my head and he said, "My favorite thing to do after school, and I've been teaching for 30 years, is to have a beer." And I think I said out loud, I definitely said it in my head, "Are you telling me that that's the answer to my problems, or where are you going with this?" And he got out a piece of paper and he wrote on the piece of paper, "I will not have a beer until you hit your weight target." And he signed it like a contract. And he stuck it on his wall next to his desk. There was no mention of the fact I was going through a pretty critical mental health challenge. There was no mention of the fact that I was clearly struggling with anorexia. There was just this commitment from him to give up something he loved and invest in my recovery and my process. And I remember looking at that piece of paper and I was just shocked. And I said to him, "Why would you do this for me?" Because in my eyes, I was so undeserving of that sort of love. And he said, "Nicole, I'm never going to understand what it's like to be a 16-year-old that's going through this, 16-year-old girl that's going through what you're going through. But what I do understand is what it feels like to be climbing a mountain that feels impossible to get to the top of. And I know what it feels like to be in pain. And I know what it feels like to be going through that alone." And that conversation, you know, it's hard to say because sliding doors, but arguably saved my life, because the trajectory I was on were people, including family and the people that love me most, was so unable to be present with what I was going through that the disassociation led to very deep denial about what I was going through. So unless something radical had happened, that was potentially the trajectory. In that moment, a very profound shift happened. And it's not that all of a sudden I restored my weight and I got better, but every time I had a moment of very intense darkness, there was a light. So I experienced what it felt like to have someone be embodied enough, vulnerable enough, willing enough to show up and be that light and guide me out of that dark time. And that healing journey was a journey. It took years from that point. And I remember calling him when I was 18, I'd graduated. He said, I've hit my weight target, you can have a beer. And obviously that was a very happy conversation for him and for me. And I asked him, do you feel like you sacrificed through that time for me? Because he stuck to his word. He didn't have a beer for 2 years, you know. And he said, at the beginning, I thought, yes, I thought I was sacrificing something for you. But what I recognized through the experience was what I gained and who you've become as a result of me leaning in has so much more reward than what that beer ever could have given me. And that taught me a very, very, very profound style of leadership, but not even just a style of leadership, a way of being in the world. And it reframed so many misconceptions about what love is. And it deeply informed my work, deeply informed my work. One of the biggest shifts in my thinking was that I think a lot of people, and I know this because I get asked it so often, a misconception that people have is, you know, where is the line between loving myself and loving others? You know, when do I, because in loving others, I'm sacrificing myself. And I used to subscribe to that way of thinking as well. But what I've come to realize in truly understanding love's nature is that there's actually no separation between loving you and loving another person. But you need to be at a point in your awareness where you see yourself in others fully. And then a synergy, you know, a unity starts to exist. That's actually always present, but our awareness is not always placed on it, because when you're seeing with eyes of division, or when you're allowing fear to keep you contracted and hesitant and in separation, because that's what fear is here to do, and it's a beautiful thing. It's meant that we've survived for millions of years. And there's an invitation now, I think, at this point of human evolution for us to not need to be so dictated to by fear. Because we don't have animals running after us. You know, we don't have the threats that we once had to our life. We have the freedom, the flexibility, many of us at least. And if we do have that freedom and flexibility, I really truly believe it's our responsibility to exercise it and to learn how to transcend fear. What I've started to recognize is when you know how to navigate through that and see the synergy and see the perfection that's ever present and see the unity that's ever present, you really start to enter a completely new paradigm of possibility. And I didn't necessarily understand that straight away after that experience, but what that experience then led me to lead and execute on in the world guided me to this exposure of humanity. So in a nutshell, after I recovered and I graduated, I founded a nonprofit, and there was a premise that I had that guided that nonprofit, which worked in mental health, which was maybe, just maybe, there are cultural and environmental reasons, the suicide rate in our world and the mental health rate in our world, the stress and anxiety and disengagement and addiction rate is so high. Perhaps there's a link between our culture and environment and those elevating statistics, because 10 years ago, the leading thought process around these challenges were mental health, addiction, really are biological predispositions, and that's it. There's nothing else we can do about it. So I had this premise that said, what if we shifted culture? What if we actually started to show up differently for one another? Surely that would have an impact, which seems obvious now. it was a very radical conversation to be having 10 years ago. No one wanted to talk about vulnerability. No one wanted to be talking about embodiment or unity consciousness. I don't even know if that was a conversation that anyone was having, maybe, I'm not sure, but definitely not in a public domain. There were no sports stars or celebrities talking about mental health, nothing. So I had to really go about this in quite a rogue social advocate sort of way, which at the time, on a very limited budget, I decided to buy a van as an 18-year-old and travel directly to communities and set up spaces and workshops where people could come and feel safe to speak their truth. Very simple concept, basically circle work. Here's a safe space. No one's going to give you advice. No one's going to tell you what to do. This is just a space to speak your truth and transcend the fear and the secrecy and the shame of what you're experiencing. After doing that for a year, things really started to snowball. Not only had, by this point, it gone from me to a team of four and two vans and two dogs, we had traveled in that year to 200 communities, we'd spoken over 150 schools, and we had an impact on over 50,000 people. And we had communities inviting us to come and hold this space. And some of the feedback we started to receive from community members and people that would participate in these circles were things like, I've had, you know, psychotherapies or various types of mental health support for decades, and nothing's even come close to how healing and therapeutic this experience was. And what I started to observe in my facilitation was the less I said, the less opinion I had, and the more open the space was, the more profound the transformation. And this really started to connect me to something very incredible about consciousness and conscious awareness and embodiment. All we need to heal is to be able to acknowledge what's trying to get our attention. And I thought back to that experience in my principal's office, and he saw me, he acknowledged what I was going through. So even though I didn't necessarily heal like that, there was a space, there was a possibility for me to lean into and walk that path of healing. And it really started to connect me to a much more quantum understanding of this existence, that we really are the conscious creator. But the more we interfere, the more we get in the way, the more we allow our judgments and our fears to interject, to put pressure on what it is we're wanting to call forward or become, the more and more difficult it is to really connect to our true power, because human beings are insanely powerful. Your consciousness is insanely powerful. Like, the degree in which a human being is multidimensional is, you know, our conscious mind, the English language, is never going to be able to fully understand. It's an experience. And so this work had a very powerful trajectory. And I ended up traveling pretty much consistently from 18 to 22, holding these spaces and running these workshops, until I got to a point where I recognized this really needs to be heard by policymakers, because the more research I was doing, the more I was seeing, like, these guys are spending billions of dollars and every year the problem's getting worse. And my team and I were working in communities with the simplest model that you could imagine, but there's a power in that simplicity. There's a power in not overcomplicating it. And that's something that I still very strongly stand by in my leadership. It's why I speak the way that I do. It's why I ensure that the content I put out is very simple, because complication creates interference. And what we want is openness and clarity. And so I was looking at these policymakers, like, investing so much money, and yet every single year the problem was getting worse statistically. The results that we were having in communities were things like, in rural parts of Australia, for example, that had, you know, a 15-20% attendance rate at their local schools, which was normal in some of these communities, which is insane when you think that Australia is a very affluent country. You don't think that these things go on, but they do in a lot of these communities that are so difficult for the government to service, to rectify. The cycle is so systemic, and I think this exists across the world in communities and areas that have intergenerational welfare, it's very difficult to break that cycle. And yet we were having these results. So an example would be we would go into the school, we would create connections with those that would be there, which would be very few, and we'd literally just, no pressure, invite them to talk if they wanted to talk. And after 6 months, 12 months, some of these schools were starting to see an increase in their attendance by like 40, 60, 70, 80%. One of the questions, one of the most powerful conversations that I had with one of the students that actually identified immediately as the school bully, that's how they introduced themselves, when I asked her, why do kids not come to school? And her response to me was, the teachers will tell you, we just don't care. But the truth is we're afraid because of the level of violence that exists within our community. You know, so there was this, again, this segregation, the teacher's projection of, well, the kids just don't care. The service provider's projection of the kids just don't care versus the reality of these students, these young people feeling not safe. And if you're not, you know, how can you force someone to go into a space when they don't feel safe? Of course, there's going to be that conflict. And so really addressing that and being present with that, which takes a lot of patience, it takes a lot of willingness, it takes a lot of embodiment to really hear that and to not blame and to not get frustrated, but to actually be with the reality of how things are and acknowledge the reality of how things are and help everyone feel seen in where things are at so that there's an opportunity for that to evolve and change. And this work started to really create itself. That system of creating safe spaces for people to come and speak their truth slowly started to become community development projects and capacity building projects, where it was the sort of work a community would call and say, we've had an increase in our suicide rate significantly in the past 6 months. Can you come and help us? So very wicked problems, complex problems, problems that really didn't have any directive from the community. But using this same system, we would go into the community, we would look at all of the stakeholders of the community. So it could have been the parents, the teachers, the students, the service providers, the council members, so on. And we would spend a whole day just listening to each stakeholder group. So we'd have a series of questions. We would give no opinion. We would just listen, take notes, hear them, actively listen. Then at the end, when we had listened to all of the stakeholders, we would bring people together in a forum and we would feed back what we heard. And what would start to happen is they started to discover through that process of being seen and heard, actually the continuity and the consistency of what each stakeholder group wanted. And what the work kept informing me of was there's so much more of what makes us the same than what separates us. Fundamentally, there is so much more that unifies us as human beings than what segregates and separates us. So I put this in a document to send to our policymakers. Again, one thing led to the next, and I found myself running an event in Parliament House that was basically about love and the importance of choosing love. Again, very radical position to be taking at that age, saying that this is the solution. But I started to speak to some of those statistics, and the policymakers, the head of health in Australia at the time, was sort of blown away by this, because never before had they considered prevention and early intervention and community development and cultural development potentially having a positive impact on some of these really detrimental statistics that were present in health. And so that's how I became the commissioner, and I was advising a $40 billion budget. So I went from living in my van, not really owning shoes, to then being escorted onto planes, being referred to as Commissioner Gibson. That was a wild trip. And again, just when you keep following your heart and staying true to yourself, that I think is the sort of gateway that love consistently will open up for you, because it's not about you. And that's what I've learned about love, is it, love is my God, and God has a will. And when you put your hand up and you say, I'm willing to be an instrument for that greater will, then your success really is inevitable. You need to be able to really embody that and be devotional in that. At least that's been my experience. But the more that I've trusted in that and listened, listening's been a huge part of that journey, the more that I've always been put on the right journey and trajectory. So 4 years working in that space, seeing that Australia, and then also looking conjunct in the other Commonwealth budgets, pretty much it was a range of between 90% and 97% of these budgets were investing in crisis intervention. So I want to make a point of this because it spoke to something that is very present in all of us on an individual level. Our government and their budgets, 97% odd of that budget was going towards crisis intervention, meaning no money was spent until the problem was so bad that it was at a point of crisis. So it was a completely reactionary system. But this system is a macro manifestation of how so many of us live our lives individually. We wait for things to get so bad before we actually start to address and be present with what's present. So how do we change this? How did I change this in government? How can we change this as individuals? We need to actually make space to listen. And it's almost like an underwhelming realization, you know, like how do you change the world? Stop trying to change it and just start listening and be responsive to what's right in front of you, because I feel like we have a lot of leaders that are so invested in making impact on billions of people, but they're not being present with the person right in front of them. And so this systemic disconnection just goes on and on and on and on and on. Because how we really change the world is through each other and being present with one another, first with ourselves and then with those who are right in front of us. And it's it can be frustrating if you're a visionary mind, if you see the breadth of things in the world that require our attention and our presence, to actually stop and breathe and be like, okay, well, how can I become more deeply the embodiment of the change I wish to see in the world? How can I treat my mom and dad, my partner, my best friend, the barista at my local coffee shop with the same amount of unconditionality and grace and presence that I wish to see embodied across the whole world? What I've recognized through my pursuits is really, this is the only way to change the world, because I've seen people working at this very high level and signing documents that will affect the lives of millions of people. And they have all of the accolades and all of the justifications as to why they're the best people making these decisions, but they're not embodied. They're not really thinking about how do I need to show up in the world for this change to be effectuated and actualized. And this is the missing piece. It becomes an intellectual conversation where you're looking at data, which is amazing and important, and you're trying to make predictions in a very intellectualized, analytical way. But if you're not embodied in that feeling, then the reality beyond you can't shift into that vibration. So when we learn to bring love into every moment, into every choice, then love is what is going to grow from that place. I think if we can start to shift our understanding of how this works and first focus on our own capacity to hold love and to hold light, to initiate ourselves deeper and deeper through love, then we can really start to create change. And things like, you know, synergistic happenings and miracles and synchronicities will start to occur more and more. And that might look like the right people coming together at the right times, who have the right skill sets to make an impact on a much larger scale. But until we're in the vibration of the solution, we're only going to be perpetuating the problem. That comes down to our personal practice. We can't bypass this. And it was the more that I was exposed to that, that's what drove me to actually leave a career in mental health and to begin Love Out Loud, because I realized what I was seeing in mental health was just a symptom of a much deeper cultural narrative that needs our attention and needs shifting. And really that shift needs to happen in every single human heart. until we have enough humans stepping up and actually committing, okay, I'm going to shift the way that I show up every day. I'm going to take responsibility for my vibration. Even when I want to blame and I want to project and I want to react, I'm actually going to bring that back to myself and ask, how can I be the change in this moment? How can I choose love in this moment? And through all of those adventures, eventually my work, especially through the commission, led me to work in over 40 countries and with 500,000 people. So I was working with people in very, very diverse settings and situations. And I was hearing the same thing again and again, which is, I just want to be seen and heard. I just want to be loved and to love. And until that is fulfilled, what starts to happen is we have people in very powerful positions of influence and decision-making who still don't feel seen and heard, who don't know how to self-source and actually find that state of love within themselves and make choices from that place. So everything they're doing is in trying to get that power or to assert that power in order to get the love that they feel is missing from their life, to feel seen, to feel validated, to feel heard. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that the people and the communities around the world have made is we put our leaders on pedestals and expect them to be beyond the humanness that all of us experience. And it's not the case. Those policymakers are navigating the same things. And not just policymakers, leaders in general. So we really have to commit first and foremost to that. What I started to see was we're only ever making two choices, love or fear. We're only ever choosing to lean in or we're choosing to lean out. And that takes a deep practice of being honest with ourselves. How can I move towards love in this moment and actually get out of my own way, trust in a force much bigger than me, let go of the need to be right, surrender my judgments, and unify myself with those around me in this moment? I mean, it sounds simple, but when you start to practice this and you start to actually connect to just how deep you need to go in order to really embody those concepts, the level of humility that is needed from all of us to actually let go of our way being the only way, or the need to be right, or the things that are keeping us separate essentially and ultimately safe, because a lot of us fear the vulnerability. We're so afraid of having those conversations. And rather than saying, I'll give a really basic example to our partner, you never do the dishes, you're the worst partner ever. What if we started to have conversations like, I really need your support. I really need you to clean up the kitchen because it makes me feel loved when you do that. Because it's that vulnerability that changes the world. Think about how many leaders have been in critical situations where they've made decisions that have affected many, many, many people, and potentially not for the better, that could have been prevented if they actually lent in with the right sort of vulnerability and said, I'm not equipped to make this decision alone. And they called on the support that they actually needed to make an ethical decision. But the pride and the fear of the vulnerability is what has prevented a more altruistic, compassionate world from being birthed. And I've seen this in so many different elements. I mean, the work that I do now is on breaking love down to help people understand how to action it more seamlessly in their life, to position love as an actionable skill set. What if we were to all see love as a skill set that wasn't just for some people, but it was actually accessible to all of us, and it was something that we could develop? This is what Love Out Loud ultimately is as a philosophy, is there's love inside of you, and the more we commit to it, the more we learn how to love out loud, how to be out of our own way, and to actually love in action, love in practice. I mean, there's so much more I can say to that. I'm also aware that I've just completely like gone into a vortex of that sharing, and I want to open the space up as well and see if you guys have any questions, because there's so many more things. There's practical hacks and steps that I can share with you. But again, I just want to make it really as relevant as I possibly can. So I'm just looking at Ella's question here. What style of school did you go to? And do you think alternative education, not just your principal, played a huge role in your worldview? Yes, I do. I definitely feel it's not necessarily the institution, but it's exposure. And I guess this is what I've learned, that I had exposure to a style of leadership that completely transformed my view of the world and opened up possibility to me. And honestly, I think when it comes to our children, all of us can be that leader in our children's lives. And all of us have a responsibility to be that leader for the children in our community, not just our own children, but the children around us. If they see demonstrations of vulnerability and people owning their emotion and saying, actually, I feel scared right now, or I feel proud right now, and I want to surrender that pride. I feel angry, and that's actually okay. If children saw this, you know, that's so world-changing for them to be validated in what they're experiencing, to not reject their emotion, because the more that we reject our emotion, it doesn't prevent that emotion from being in our bodies. And then it's playing out in all these other ways, through violence, through shadow, through manipulation, you know, trying to get back that sense of power because we haven't actually allowed ourselves to be embodied in our own experience and what's truly present. And I think most of us growing up in the world have had some sort of shutdown, you know, like very few people were met as a child in every single moment of emotion with the presence they needed to feel balanced. So if you didn't experience that presence as a child, you're going to compensate in two ways. You're either going to become really forceful to dominate and assert your needs, or you're going to yield to the need of others to compensate for that absence of harmony. And I think that this is something that we shouldn't just rely on schools for. I think this is every person's responsibility. And of course, the more we integrate these understandings into our schools, the better. However, what I will say on this, again, coming back to embodiment, we can design the best schooling system in the world in theory, but unless those teachers that are working with our kids are embodied in this way of being, it won't make a difference. I could have been in any school. I could have been in a mainstream school. If I had met my principal who was embodied in those moments of vulnerability, it would have had an equal impact. So let's not get too caught up on what it needs to look like and just come back to who we need to be in order for this change to truly happen. Okay, I'm just answering Carla's question, and then I can answer. I just saw your hand go up, Michael, so I can answer yours, and then Oliver's as well. If the traumas of our childhood made us who we are, don't you think that we all need as humans constant free psychological therapy? I want to keep coming back to the point that I just made in answering Ella's question. From my experience, and again, this is just my experience and my perception, I don't necessarily believe that any one system is the solution. I think it's when we realize that how we interact with each other and our relationships to one another is what ultimately creates the system, nothing will shift. Because you can design a very theoretically brilliant system, theoretically brilliant bureaucratic structure, but if the way people are showing up in that is disconnected and absent of embodiment, then the solution doesn't have the space to actually be birthed. So yeah, I mean, it would be amazing to have the services that we need. But again, there's variables to that. Who are the practitioners? You know, are they embodied? Are they the right practitioner for that individual? I think the most sustainable, foolproof solution is when all of us start doing the work. And what I know about love and what you start to be connected to, the more you fall in love and the more you embody love, the more you're in a state of love, is there really is a perfect synergy that is ever present, and love will work through you in all moments to serve its greater will. Rumi said it best, that love is only ever seeking more of itself. And what if you were to see yourself as that messenger, as that custodian, as that change maker, rather than constantly delegating it out to, it needs to be the teacher, it needs to be the teacher, it needs to be the psychologist, it needs to, how would the world be if all of us put ourselves in a position of leadership and inspired others around us to do the same? I feel like this, to me, would create a lot more cohesion and a lot more safety. And I can speak to that on my, from my personal experience. I had a lot of psychological support through those years of recovery. But when I would go home to parents that didn't know how to feel comfortable in holding me and what I was going through, it actually sometimes felt more painful, because I would go to a space, I'd rip myself open, the time would be up, okay, go home now, and then I'd have to pretend like it was all okay and take on the burden of my parents' pain, because I felt like the cause of that. So that's just my example, but I think this would play out in many ways. Ultimately, I think all of us need to play our part in learning how to be present, and then trusting that we're going to be in the perfect situation in all moments to bring more love to others and to the world. Michael, did you want to ask your question?
Michael, please unmute your mic. I've asked you to unmute your microphone. There you go.
That within your own being, you need to reach and find the source of positive energy that you can then share. And that if you're in that moment, kind of moment where it's not there, you can't find that source, which is, you just need to do more time in the workshop of, you know, learning how to be loving to yourself. And I'm much older than you are, but I've had more practice at not being loving to myself. And discovering simple thing, like today I was texting my son who's 40 and saying in the text, I just thought of you and it made me happy, just happy to think of you. And he wrote back, oh, gee, he was really excited, you know, to get such a direct hit from his dad, because we always are talking about what we do together, you know, as he's a filmmaker, I'm a filmmaker. So there's lots to talk about, but rarely do we get to have that. Do I get to say that sort of simple thing, which was genuine? It was an authentic experience for me, a kind of a new experience, just to be grateful and happy that he's in the world without any attachments. So I guess I'm just saying that it feels hopeful to me that at this time, that kind of spontaneous feeling is arising without quid pro quo exchanges of all kinds with other people as well as my son.
Thank you, Michael, for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I think that there's such a potent sentiment in that I want to draw everyone's awareness to, which is your experience in your embodiment, in your feeling, in sending that. And I think all of humans are wired for that. And actually, I can explain why. You know, our survival depended on us being and having the sense of kinship, because we needed each other for our survival. So when we lean in to one another, it puts us in a really positive state. Like when you study a human being's chemicals, when they're in connection and in a state of love, they have increased amounts of serotonin, oxytocin, dopamine, all of these really positive hormones and feelings, because that's making us stronger. So it's actually becomes addictive in a way for us to want to choose love when we can overcome those fears. And when you think about it from this space of, what you're experiencing when you're being loving, it's of course making you feel more expanded. So doesn't it make sense that more solutions are going to come into our frame of reference when we're in a more expanded state, when we're not in our own way? we're actually providing space for those solutions to occur, for us to have a stronger state of appreciation. Like, this isn't woo-woo. You can study this with science. If you study the human's physiology when they're in a state of love, they're expansive, their auric field is stronger. The heart is more intelligent than the mind. That's proven now. The mind, the heart knows information before the mind does. Like, that's profound. So when we trust in this, I didn't realize as I was going through the trauma I experienced as a young person that my heart was actually closed. I had these intellectualized versions of experiencing emotion. And the more that I healed and came into my heart, I was like, wow, this speaks to me. This is actually, it speaks to me. This is an energy center. So is my gut. But for so many of us, they've been shut down and we don't actually recognize that this is an intelligence. That's another brain, as our gut is, that's guiding us. I just want to add to that quickly. I think a lot of people have an awareness that they should choose love in moments. So there's, again, a very simple example. Maybe you've had a fight with a friend. You have an awareness that the right thing to do is apologize. But there's still something that gets in your way. And I want to speak to that because this is the embodiment piece. There's a difference between having the awareness and then actually the practice of increasing your capacity. I call it getting fit for love. All of us need to get fitter for love because love is such an expansive vibration that if you've been, like Michael was sharing, in a consistent state of the opposite of love, being self-critical or self-punishing or self-hating or whatever that is, or judging of others, your nervous system is used to contraction. Like your physiology is actually used to being in a contracted state. So when you start to open your heart and all of a sudden you're expansive and there's so much beauty and pleasure, actually your system is like, I don't know how to handle this. I'm not fit enough to handle this. And just like getting fit when you start running, the only way to do it is through practicing it. You've got to just do it more and more and more. You know, running sucks if you've never run and you go for your first run. It's hard. It's hard work. But if you keep running, eventually that fitness increases. And I promise you'll get to a point where it becomes the baseline. And that to me is a powerful idea. What if love became the baseline for how we operated as a species? What could we create then? Okay, so maybe have time. Do I have time, Virginia, for one more question?
Yes, you do. So can you see them? Do you want me to?
I'm happy for maybe, if you want to choose one, I can, so it doesn't seem like I'm there's any favoritism happening.
There's so many good ones though. Do you have practical exercises? I'll go with this one to do, especially when it feels tough to be open to what's going on. You just spoke to it a little bit, can you?
Definitely, yes. There's a few that are very powerful and simple. The first is becoming aware of what it means for you to practice more generosity of your spirit. So what, just that question day to day, like how can I be more generous right now? Not just in a, you know, I'm going to shout my mate's lunch, although it might look like that, but how can I give that man on the street 1 second more of my eye contact? Yeah. How can I actually, I see my friend's message and it feels a little bit inconvenient right now to reply. So I'm just going to ignore it for 3 days. Because I'm busy. A little bit more generosity in that moment isn't sitting down and writing a 30-minute reply. It's, hey, I'm really busy right now. I'm really thinking of you and I love you. Give me a few days and I'll reply to this. That's generosity of spirit. And it doesn't take much time, but it will improve your life significantly. Significantly, it will create openings in your life. You know, I think so many of us are so hard on ourselves. And if we can't show up perfectly, then we don't show up at all. This is a pattern that many of us have because we're so scared of being wrong, you know, because that's how we were raised. Unless you can be perfect, unless you get it right, then you're wrong. There's no areas of gray in that. There's no space for humanness. So I would begin there. The second thing is actually the practice of what Michael just shared. I would call this an acknowledgement practice. So this is particularly powerful when you have people in your life that trigger you or that you have conflict with. Just try it out. Become a person that is big enough to not only lean into that discomfort, but acknowledge something you really see in that individual. This fundamentally changed my life and how I related to people. If you can take some time today to maybe think of someone that you've held a grudge against or that you're in a conflict with, or, you know, maybe someone that's triggered you or that you've held judgments towards, and actually call them or write them a message and say, I've really just been sitting with myself during this embodiment conference and a few things came to my awareness. And I just wanted to let you know that I really see whatever it is, this strength that you demonstrate that actually really intimidates me. And that's put me in a situation where I feel like I judge you because I don't know how to be with that. And I just wanted to voice it because I actually, underneath that intimidation, I really admire it. Just watch how being brave enough to have those sorts of conversations will transform your life. And then the third really practical and probably the one that I implement the most in my life is just the moment-to-moment awareness of, am I open right now or am I closed? That's it. Is my body open or am I closed? And try and spend just a little bit more time day to day in a state of openness.
I almost don't want to speak and wrap up the talk, actually, because I'd love to have you go on. But we do have to wrap up, and there is another talk in 1 hour and lots of more talks coming up here on the channel. So do tune in for that. In the meantime, do drop by the coffee breakout room. The links are there for you in the chat. You can engage with other participants. You can engage with presenters. I hope you will be dropping in, Nicole, because I'd love to chat more about everything you said. The next talk on the channel will be by Atira Tan, and it will be on, hold on a minute. I'm just too mesmerized by your talk, so I'm not paying attention to any of my documents, actually. Yes. I was just listening to what you were saying and trying to take notes at the same time. So that's not probably the best idea, one first thing. But we do have the talk, yes. And Atira will be speaking about healing from sexual trauma, reclaiming the felt sense of safety. So that will be kind of going on what you said as well. Mm-hmm. If you want to revisit this, do buy the recordings. I mean, you can have them for life. There is the learning list and notes, and you can use them as audio only. The link is in the chat. Do the loving thing for yourself and upgrade, and it's also loving to others who can't afford this. So you're helping others too by buying the recordings. And I do want you to round us up with one top tip, Nicole.
Oh, did you say, are you going to ask me a question or is there something?
That's just your final word on this.
Just thank you. No tips, just a thank you and a gratitude for being present with me and this talk and everyone that's watching in the Facebook community. And whether you guys consciously know it or not, you're definitely a part of the Love Out Loud family. So yeah, you're a part of my family and thank you.
I can't thank you enough. Thank you to the channel managers as well. Thank you to Christina, who's here with us, for putting this together and bringing our attention to this amazing human being and her work, which is very needed. Nicole, I know I'll be looking you up and looking more into your work. Thank you to all of you who tuned in and your comments and questions. And there's always never enough time, but let's keep engaging in the Facebook groups, in the Intimacy and Relationships Facebook group as well, in the Embodiment Conference Facebook group. I'll see you again. Keep enjoying the conference. Thank you, Nicole, so much.